When our nation's veterans came home from serving their country, the American Legion helped them with the GI Bill to get a head start. When they came home from Vietnam, we helped those affected with Agent Orange to get care and compensation. Now, there is a new war raging. Unfortunately, it is being fought in the hearts and minds of those who served. Veteran suicide is the most important issue facing veterans today, and too many are battling it alone. So join us. Make the pledge. Be the one to help the American Legion end veteran suicide.
Welcome to the Express Soul Health and Wellness Podcast. In each episode, you'll learn from experts about the best practices and technologies to live a happier, healthier, and hopefully a longer life. Here is your host, Claudia Erdenola.
Welcome to Express Soul Health and Wellness Podcast. My name is Claudia Erdenola. I am a professional engineer with a passion for health and wellness. If this is your first time at our podcast, I'm inviting you to subscribe, hit the notification button, and follow us in all our social media outlets. Today, we are focused on mental health, specifically post-traumatic stress disorder, in recognition to the National Vietnam War Veterans Day. I invited Bruce Robertson, my husband, to talk about PTSD affecting our military veterans. Bruce is a U.S. Air Force veteran. He served in the war in Southeast Asia. And today with him, we're going to bring a lot of historical facts about that war, also the traumas, the horrors, and the memories that never leave those who serve in combat zones. We're going to bring light into what is PTSD and what we can do to help those that are suffering from PTSD. PTSD is a post-traumatic stress disorder, a disorder that develops when a person has experienced or witnessed a scary, shocking, terrifying, or dangerous event. These stressful or traumatic events usually involve a situation where someone's life has been threatened or severe injury has occurred. Bruce himself has been suffering PTSD. Even today, he is part of the PTSD groups and the VA, the Veterans Affairs Hospital, and it's a great thing because he can bring healing to the problem. But part of Bruce's healing was going back to retrace his steps in Southeast Asia, Thailand, and Vietnam, to see the places where he was over 50 years ago, to see the people in their eyes and see how they are today after more than 50 years of peace. This episode is about mental health and emotional scars and memories from war that never fade in the minds and souls of our military veterans. I accompanied Bruce on his journey to the past to bring healing, and I would like to invite you, all our listeners, veterans and non-veterans, to join us on this tribute to those who served in one of the longest and most devastating wars of all times, the Vietnam War. With no further ado, here with you, Bruce Robertson. Bruce, welcome to Express All Health and Wellness Podcast, and thank you for your service and for all of our Vietnam veterans. A belated welcome home. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. I would like to start our conversation by asking you to tell our listeners what was going on in your personal life and in the country back when you were 18 years old?
Well, I was just finishing high school. And as you can imagine, kids that are finishing high school are looking at what they're going to do with the rest of their lives, going to college. I'm going to, you know, pick out a career or something like that. At that time, the Vietnam War was raging. and they had initiated a draft. A draft means that you're given a draft card and a number. And at 18, my number was coming up because I was prime to be recruited in the military service through a draft to go and participate in this war in Southeast Asia. So it was a very tumultuous time. In 1963, President Kennedy was assassinated. 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And in 1968 as well, Robert F. Kennedy, the attorney general who was running for president, was also assassinated. So it was a very much a time of upheaval in our country. I mean, we think about everything that goes on today and we think it's terrible. But, you know, as I've reminded you, I've seen worse. And that was a very, very, again, I use the word tumultuous time back in 1966.
So as I can imagine, I mean, you were living the life of a normal 18-year-old. I know that your dad also was a war veteran, correct?
Yes, my dad served in World War II, and he served in North Africa, Burma, in different sectors. And when during World War II, those veterans went away to war, unlike we were required to serve 1 year in a combat zone in the Southeast Asia theater, they went away until the war was over. So he served 10 years with the U.S. Army. And so I grew up listening to his war stories, and he was very much a patriot. So I think a lot of that was passed on to me and, you know, my brothers as well.
So you were enlisted. So where do you go from there?
My first duty station after I completed my basic training and technical training was headquarters NORAD in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. And NORAD is a North American Air Defense Command, and it's really a underground secret base that listens for objects entering our airspace. It's kind of one of the really early warning systems in case our country was under attack.
And you were there when you received the orders to go to Southeast Asia?
Oh, yeah. It was great duty in a great part of the country with the Rocky Mountains mm-hmm. right there. And one day I received orders. My sergeant came to me and says, "Robertson, you just got orders." And I said, "Where to?" And he said, "Southeast Asia." And I said, "Oh, my God." So my world changed drastically after about a year of service in the Air Force.
So when you got to Southeast Asia, where do you were stationed?
I got assigned to a remote secret base in Northeast Thailand. It's called Nakhon Phnom, commonly referred to as NKP. And it's right on the Mekong River, just a stone's throw across the river to Laos. And there was also conflict going on in Laos. So this base, we had five bases in Thailand at that time. And Thailand was one of the staging areas for a lot of the war activities in Laos, on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and in Vietnam as well. In fact, 80% of all the U.S. Air Force strikes in North Vietnam originated from Thailand, and a lot from my base.
And I didn't know that. Wow. So I just trying to imagine you at 18 years old with a bunch of other young men in Southeast Asia holding arms and getting trained for this war. Do they explain you exactly what were your duties?
Yeah, we knew what our duties were based on what we'd been trained to do in basic training. And mine was in the security forces. And I was assigned to the 56th Special Operations Wing in Nakhon Phnom, Thailand. And once I got there, I met with my squadron and quickly learned that our duties were to secure the base. And also, in the event there were activities outside of the base, such as airplanes that went down due to battle damage, we were to jump on a helicopter and go out and secure that assets. Because at that time, it was called the Nixon Secret War in Southeast Asia. We weren't supposed to be in Laos. Neither were the communists, the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong. That was through a mutual agreement between the U.S. and Vietnam, but both countries violated that significantly. So I had a few trips, a few missions over across border into Laos and other areas. And some, quite frankly, I didn't even know where I was. I knew what the mission was, but I could have been in North Vietnam. I could have been in Cambodia or Laos. It was
kind of a mission. You were not told where you were going.
Sometimes. We would jump in a Jolly Green with an interpreter and some more security forces guys, and the helicopter would fly toward North Vietnam and would land. Well, it wouldn't even land. It stayed above a rice paddy because it was kind of really wet and during the monsoons. And we'd jump out of the helicopter and go out to the crash site and start securing that asset because we weren't supposed to be there. So there were no emblems on the airplane. There was no emblems on our uniforms in case for some reason we got captured. There would not be proof that we were actually there, or, you know, we tried to not leave evidence that we were operating in an area that we had agreed upon through treaty not to operate in. So it was called Nixon Secret War, but they were there and we were there.
So you probably had several situations where you were dropped in a location in the middle of a jungle and left there for days. What was going on in your mind?
What was going on in my mind? What am I doing here? And when I saw that helicopter leave and left me in the middle of the jungle with the other guys, and then, you know, I heard gunfire not too far from me, and then I saw basically tribes people, very primitive people coming out of the jungles. These were the Montagnard tribes people in Laos, or the Patho Laotians, which are communist operating in that area as well. And so, you know, there was some skirmishes, and I felt like, you know, if I ever get out of this, everything's downhill from here. So I got to know some of the people in the jungle. We camped out. I shared our food with them, which at that kind of, it was not called meals ready to eat. It was called sea rations. So we tried to bond with the local people there in the jungle, and until we could get that, all the pieces of that aircraft out of their country and back to our base.
Out of all of those, I will say, very tense and dramatic days that you lived there during the war, because you were serving in the combat zones, do you have like a memory that you say, out of everything, out of all of them, this is one that it will always be with me more than anything else, traumatized me to my core, that I always relive over and over in my dreams, in my memories, in my nightmares? What would be that memory?
You know, when you go to an area like that in a combat zone, you kind of look at things on a day-to-day basis. You have a calendar, at least I did. A lot of the guys did. You had a calendar on the wall and you'd mark each day off. And so picking out one particular situation that gave you nightmares is sometimes difficult. But I can remember being in firefights at night with helicopters dropping illumination flares, and there would be razor wire around our base. And it was our job to take our weapons and keep the enemy from invading our base. So I remember bullets whizzing by my head. They were called tracers. You know, these bullets actually lit up so you could see them and you could hear them go by your heads, by your head. And then, you know, I can tell you, I thought I was a pretty brave guy, but it scares the hell out of you. And, you know, so it's just an awful time. But beyond that, one thing I remember, because staying in the jungle so much and being on the what they call the tiger flight, it meant I worked all night. When the sun went down, mm-hmm. I went out in the jungle, and I didn't come back until the sun came up, which is a rough time. It's when the probability of the enemy striking was greatest. So I was on that tiger flight. And even during the monsoon seasons, when the lightning was crackling and the thunder was rolling, and I looked down, and the thing I wanted to do, keep my poncho on and keep my weapon dry. Your weapon was your lifeline. And I remember just seeing mosquitoes up and down my arm, just kind of just feasting on me. Now, we had mosquito repellent. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. We also had malaria pills that we mm-hmm. took to help prevent that, but that was really tough on my stomach. So I contracted malaria, and I got a real bad case of malaria. So I went to the base hospital that we had at Nekampanon, and they diagnosed me and decided I need to be medevaced to a better hospital in Thailand. So I got medevaced to a hospital in Karat, Thailand.
So how long you were at the hospital?
I was at the hospital for about a month. And remember, back in that time in 1968 and 69, we didn't have the internet. Cell phones didn't exist. Communications between halfway around the world in the United States was very limited. Basically, there was snail mail, which basically meant it would take 2 weeks or 3 weeks for a letter you wrote to get back to the States, and then probably about 3 weeks for it to come back. So communication was very sparse and very limited. So I was in the hospital about a month, and nobody knew where I was. They didn't know whether I was dead or alive. So, that was a bad time. I was very sick in the hospital. And it wasn't just a hospital for people with malaria. Next to me, I remember there was a sort of a glass room, and there was a pilot who had been shot down and recovered, and he was burnt from head to toe and just screaming in agony. And other GIs, whether it's airmen or soldiers in this hospital as well, with other problems, whether it's wounds or gunshot wounds or whatever. But it was
losing limbs.
That was a horrible time. So I went about a month with malaria, almost died. I'm normally around 190 pounds. I was 140 pounds at that time. And so that was very difficult. So anyway, remember that. I had dreams of that as well.
God, I just can't imagine. I saw a movie wasn't that movie. I saw the hospital, the images of the hospital, and the conditions of the GIs that were wounded was crazy. I mean,
I think you were thinking about what was the actor?
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise. And that was Born on the 4th of July.
There you go. Is that one.
And that movie kind of reminded me of my life, because he was a high school student and very much was a patriot and was happy to join the military and go do his part. Like, I felt like my father's war was World War II, and this is a war that I needed to participate in as a patriot.
So when you returned, you were treated for malaria. You were very, very in bad condition. They thought you were going to die. They decided to send you home. What happened back home?
We were required to do 1 year in that part of the world, and whether it's Thailand or Vietnam, we were, it was a combat zone, and we were required to do 1 year in a combat zone. So I was almost at the end of my tour. I think it was about 11 months when I contracted malaria. And so after the hospital, I didn't have a uniform. A month later, I didn't know where my uniform was, because when they shipped me out from my base to Karat, I don't think I had a uniform at that time. So when I was discharged, they told me to go in this closet where they just had remnants of different uniforms, Army, Marines, Air Force, put a uniform together and go back to your base. So I did that and got back to my base, and we had this crazy first sergeant who's kind of in charge of the troops around the living areas. And he said, "Robertson, there's some senator from the States raising hell. They haven't heard from you. Get your gear and get out of here. Get on the next hop." So I caught a C-130, and then I flew to Bangkok, and I waited for over 24 hours for availability for a hop, is what they call it, a hop back to the States. So there was this one cargo plane, and I finally got on, and I remember getting on in the cargo bay and sitting in the web seating. And this is something that is in my mind and will always stick in my mind. There, it was me and 48 coffins draped with this flag going back to the United States. I came over with 300 young men my age, and I was going back with 48 who didn't make it. So there's a saying that all gave some, but some gave all, and these guys gave it all. So although I was sick and I'd been through a lot of trauma, nothing like these guys. So anyway, that will always stick in my mind. Coming back for the first few months, anytime it rained or thundered, I was back in Southeast Asia. I was back during the monsoons. I was in the jungle with my guns. And I'd wake up in sweats and then realize that I was home. And then there was such a feeling of relief at that point. Hey, everything's cool. You're safe.
How was the reception of the people in general when you return home from war?
It's nothing like it is today for the troops that were in Iraq or Afghanistan. When we came back from Southeast Asia, that was a very unpopular war. You know, a lot of people thought we shouldn't be there. You know, I won't take a position on that right now. But in fact, some people were leaving the country, going to Canada, so they couldn't get drafted into that war. So it was such a upheaval with the population and the war being unpopular. Certain things happened over there, like the My Lai incident, which I'll talk about later on. But when we came back, they would actually, you know, spit on veterans in uniform or just, you know, call them names, baby killers, you know, rapists and things of that nature. So that it didn't feel good. You didn't get thank you for your service. You didn't get welcome home. You basically, in as much as possible, wanted to de-identify with being in the military. So your uniform was a target for the people in this country who did support the war, and it was a very unpopular war. So that wasn't a welcome home. So that was a bad time for all the veterans who were served in Southeast Asia and Vietnam, Thailand, places like that, or anywhere else in the world, Okinawa, the Philippines, whatever. We weren't looked at as heroes. We were not considered heroes. We were kind of, you know, looked down upon, quite frankly.
57 years ago, and you have these memories and so fresh in your mind, I want to give my audience a little perspective, because being a wife of a veteran, I can attest that there are many times where you have these terrible nightmares and you wake up sweating and terrified, and like it was yesterday. And it's difficult for anyone to relate to that. And that's why it's so important that we have this discussion today, because PTSD is a common denominator in our military veterans from Vietnam and from even more contemporary wars. It's a silent war. It's a silent battle that many, many are dealing with right now. And we need to talk about this and bring perspective, awareness, and action to help those.
You know, in the military, they want in the military, they want you to be tough, you know, take
That's
the pain,
right.
whatever. And showing that you want to talk to somebody, whether it's a chaplain or, you know, a counselor or whatever, if you're in the military, has always been viewed as weakness. Now, during World War II, when my father was in the war, they called it shell shock. PTSD was called shell shock when somebody was in battle and, quite frankly, they just got out of themselves and couldn't take it anymore. They were a mess. So there was a lot of people who suffered shell shock, you know, during war or after war. Today they call it PTSD, but it's basically the same thing.
I want to read something, Bruce, that I found an extremely profound phrase. It says, PTSD is not a sign of weakness. It is a sign of absolute strength. PTSD is earned by doing what others fear.
That's right, because only 1% of the current population, I think it was like 4% during the Vietnam era war, served. And I don't think most people can even imagine the sights, the sounds, the smells, the horrors that, whether you're in Iraq, Afghanistan, Korea, or Vietnam, really experience. And again, is the military teaches you to be tough, to suck it up. Sometimes you don't want to talk about this. And every veteran listening to this podcast has a story. And it's great if you listen to their story. Not that they're going to volunteer it for you, but, you know, ask them about themselves. They still want to be relevant. And the ones that aren't talking are the ones that you need to try to encourage to talk about it.
Well, that is something that we definitely are working on here from our company, from Expressol Coffee. We team up with the American Legion in this beautiful campaign, Be the One program, to help end veteran suicide and bring awareness and action. And I definitely think that many people, and I want them to listen at this podcast, and what you have to share with us today. In this first part, we are basically going through your a very short a synopsis of your past. But we're going now to talk about what you're dealing right now, many PTSD. And I know a lot of my listeners would like to participate in how I can help. And we're going to tell them how. But right now, I want to bring this perspective because talking about it is part of the healing. And I know that part of the healing that you wanted to bring to you was going back and retrace your steps, your footsteps in Southeast Asia. And
well,
I want you to tell us about it. Our Expressol Health and Wellness podcast is sponsored by Expressol Coffee. Expressol Coffee is our brand of coffee that we created with your health in mind. And as you know, you probably see this all over social media. We launched recently our Be The One coffee, which is the coffee that is an initiative that we are doing with the American Legion to support Be The One program to help end veteran suicide. So every time you purchase Be The One coffee, you are part of the solution. You are helping to prevent veteran suicide. So just go www.expressolcoffee.com. You can use code LEGION for a 15% off of your order. And I want to thank you. Thank all of you who already purchased Be The One coffee, because you are helping veterans in need. You are being part of the solution. For all of you that still don't know how delicious, how amazing is our coffee, and you want to be part of the solution, go to www.expressolcoffee.com, enter code LEGION for 15% off your purchase. And remember, shipping is free. on all orders over $50. Thank you for your support.
As I'm older now, an older veteran, I wanted to kind of go back, retrace my military history, going all the way back to Joint Base Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and meeting with some people that in the units that I was in, where I was trained, see the sites, to visit Lackland again, to go to San Antonio and see some of the places that I went to even then.
To train as a military working dog handler.
Yeah, I was trained in the security forces and also additionally trained as a military working dog handler, which we had these amazing animals. Today they're using Belgian Malinois as the dog of choice. Back when I was in, it was more of the typical German Shepherds, but it was great seeing those guys. And I asked the guys at the kennels, I said, can you put one of these dogs on me? Because part of the training when I went through, you had to go out one day and what they call catch all the dogs. So all the dogs that were being trained, they let them loose on you to bite you, you know. And so I said, can you put a dog on me? I'd like to catch a dog again one more time. And they said, sure, if you'll sign this waiver. They were kidding, of course, but they actually allowed it. They put me in a jacket, you know, padded jacket, and turned this dog loose on me, which I, believe it or not, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the interaction with the dog handler, the guys at the kennel, and the dog itself. So that was a wonderful experience. So that was kind of step one in retracing my military history. Step two, I wanted to go back to Southeast Asia, to those places, and Thailand and Laos and Cambodia, Vietnam, and kind of face those demons. When I was there at 18 years old, it was a tense time. We were at war. And I wanted to see what's happened in 57 years to the place, to the people, see how they would receive me, see how I would receive them. So I had to complete that circuit on that experience. And I don't know if a lot of guys listening to this have gone back, or if they're contemplated going back, or whether, like when I left, I said, I never want to see this place again, you know, because, and this is going to be
traumatic.
Pretty common to a lot of the veterans. You get desensitized to a place that you dislike. You get desensitized to the people to a certain degree. You don't even really see that as a civilized place. In fact, we use the expression that they would ask you a question, how much longer you have? When are you going back to the world? The world was the U.S. That place was not the world. I mean, it's a total opposite end of the globe. But again, you become desensitized toward that culture. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back with a different perspective, having lived my life, having developed my career and gone through my career, having raised children, I wanted to go back where I'd had the time to interact with the people again, the country. I wanted to smell the food. I wanted to, you know, look at the vegetation, and I wanted to meet with the people.
And I was there with you on that journey. And that was an experience that was incredible, but we're going through that step by step to bring that story to our listeners. I want to ask you, Bruce, when we prepared the trip and you were so focused on making sure that we were going to the places that you were, you want to go there and see the people to their eyes, you know, see the place, what happens after, you know, over 50 years of peace. What were your first thoughts when we arrived to Thailand?
When the plane landed and we went, I guess, east from Miami to Doha, which is in the Saudi Arabia area, from there to Phuket.
Qatar.
When the plane landed in Phuket, I was looking out the window. I wanted to see the earth. I wanted to see if the dirt was the same color that I remember. I wanted to see the jungle. And then anxiously, when we deplaned, got our luggage, somebody was supposed to be meeting us with our name, and I went there, and there was this Thai lady, and she spoke English. She was our guide, and then we had a driver assigned to us as well. It's all part of the package. Not as expensive as you think it is. Prices are really great over there. So we were riding to our first destination in the car, which is our hotel, and I was talking to them. And actually, I speak enough Thai to get by. And restaurants here in the States, like Thai restaurants, I'd go out and I'd say, Sawadee ka, kun sabade lu to the people. And, you know, sometimes they wouldn't be Thai. They would be Korean or Vietnamese or whatever. So I said, you're not a real Thai. And so I started talking to them in Thai. And they were surprised that I spoke any Thai at all. And I explained to them that I had served duty in Thailand during the Vietnam War, and the driver is this guy, and he was younger than me. I'd say 60, 61, and he remembered airmen and soldiers during that time. And when I was talking to him, he held his arm up and says, "Look, the hairs are standing up on my arm." So anyway, that was the first connection back with the people in Thailand, Southeast Asia. So that was great. And it was good because the more I talked, the more Thai came back to me, and they were even more surprised as well. You haven't been here in 57 years and you still remember that. So
it was very surprising for me too, because you speak a little bit of Thai and say hello to the people in Thai, whatever. But when I saw you having a fluent conversation there, I was blown away that you remember that much. And more days were passed by, more words and expressions, and you were recognizing places. We went to Chiang Mai and remembered the smells and the common expressions there. It was very interesting. But then From Chiang Mai, we flew to Ho Chi Minh City, which, just to give a little idea here, our listeners, you were very antsy to get to Vietnam because, tell us why.
First of all, when I talk about the smells, I lost my sense of smell after the war over there because I was in an area and in a job being outside of the base in the jungles, that I was exposed to the defoliant Agent Orange, which I'm sure a lot of you guys and girls that were similar duty in that area are dealing with as well. In fact, I'm receiving treatment from the VA for that, as well as PTSD. I'm still in PTSD encounter groups, and it's all done virtually. And it's not only, I think there's one or two guys that were in Vietnam. There are several people, or more people, in Afghanistan and Iraq. But, you know, that's, and again, we served in different war eras, but I feel like we're all brothers and sisters, and it's just
amazing. The
problems
are the same. Amazing. The mental memory is everything.
So, you know, and again, people are very closed-lipped, and to get them to open up takes a little while, but this is healthy. It's healthy to open up. But to go back to your original question about going to
Vietnam.
Ho Chi Minh City, and I'm sorry, I won't use Ho Chi Minh City. I'll use Saigon because that's what I'm accustomed
original
to.
Name.
And I was more anxious about that because, you know, really, even though we had five bases and Thailand was used for a launching pad for a lot of the operations in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, the real epicenter of the fighting was done in Vietnam. Again, a lot of cross-border activities, but, you know, the real fighting and the real harm was done in Vietnam. So it's a communist country. Thailand has been free for 1,000 years and as a king. And, you know, people are, in my opinion, much more docile and welcoming.
Relaxed.
And but the intensity in Vietnam was greater. So that's what I anticipated. And that was the reality. And then, you know, we met our driver and guide over there. And
our guide was Anne.
Anne's father, he was kind of standoffish. The guy in Thailand was very interactive, very friendly guy. Anne was Vietnamese. His father was a military officer in the North Vietnamese Army. And Anne was about 49. His father had passed. But he was standoffish, and I was standoffish because I think we were kind of feeling each other out. He was extremely intelligent and let's say very knowledgeable about the history of Vietnam and as it relates to the war. And so we didn't say much the first day because we got settled in our hotel. But the next day we started our activities, going to the different sites that were kind of laid out and was in our agenda, and we'll go through that. But next morning he asked me, says, "So how old are you?" And he said, "When were you born?" And I said, August 8th, 1948, because I don't know if this is true or not, but that's, a lot of people don't think, you know, I'm of the age to have been in the Vietnam.
He asked several ways. He asked it several times, like, so what age you were when you were here? What year you born? So he was really like, I need to make sure this guy was serving in Vietnam. Like, he didn't believe you were your age.
So he was starting to point out locations like the embassy, and everybody remembers a scene, even if you watched the movie, about the helicopters and the people wanting to get on the helicopters as we were evacuating Saigon, much like the pictures more recently where we're evacuating Afghanistan. You know, to me, it's very similar. So he was pointing out, and he's saying, that's where the embassy was, that's where the CIA office was, and he kept alluding to CIA. So I think he kind of thought maybe I was CIA, but I said, no, I was Air Force. And anyway, that loosened up over time. And then we spent the next 4 days with him going through different sites and places that we wanted to see in South Vietnam.
So the next day after we arrived, we started this visiting these historical places. First place was the Presidential Palace. How do you find that place?
I found it very educational. I saw where Henry Kissinger had been there. I saw information about the Paris peace talks. I saw information about Ho Chi Minh and his postures. And actually, you know, I learned that Ho Chi Minh actually wanted to align with the U.S. And for whatever reason, we agreed not to. So I think a lot of that early on, not being able to reconcile with the leadership in North Vietnam caused the war to get bigger and wider. So that the presidential palace was nice, and so we spent maybe 4 hours there before we went on to the next stop.
Next stop was the Cu Chi Tunnel complex.
Yeah, that's something, and I don't know any of you guys or girls that served in Vietnam had an opportunity to go there. The airport in Saigon is called Tan Son Nhut. And there was actually a big Air Force base in Tan Son Nhut at that time. But we went out to the Cu Chi tunnels where the Viet Cong had created this extensive labyrinth of tunnels, not only just tunnels, but storage rooms, hospitals, ammunition storage areas. Reminds me very much of what I hear these days in the news about what's going on in the Gaza with the tunnels over there. But it was amazing. They actually had started these in 1948 when the French were there, and then continued to build those out when the Americans were there.
And they were all across Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. But I'm telling you something, I'm an engineer, and I was blown away by the level of sophistication in which they were so creative in the way that they lay out the tunnel systems. And it's not, I don't want the listeners to think that the tunnel is just a linear tunnel. No. We're talking that underground, they created a system of tunnels that had hospitals. They were cooking for thousands of people. You imagine you're cooking underground. They learned how to cook without creating a smoke, because if the smoke was going out, the Americans were going to see them, and they were hiding. So they created a system in which they were cooking, and they were concealing the smells and diffusing the fumes, so they couldn't see the smoke. They have meeting places. They have places underground when they were storage the armament. They were training the people. I mean, they were living underground, and then it was very, very, very interesting to see how they did that. The hand tools was not.
Yeah, it was basically a hoe with a handle about a foot long, and then they would have baskets. They would dig the dirt and take it out, and to use such crude tools to build such a sophisticated tunnel system was unbelievable. You know, there's no way that they could match the sophistication of the U.S., but they were very ingenious in their what they were able to do with limited technology. I mean, because we had the bombs, we had the B-52s. There were craters, B-52 craters, where they dropped bombs outside of the tunnel areas. And underground was totally not affected. So I actually, and we have some pictures of this, I'm not a huge person, average, but I crawled down in the tunnels, and it got narrow at the point I had to crawl on my knees. But it's very well designed for the smaller people of Vietnam.
Something that also caught my attention was the ingenuity that they use to create these traps. And I mean, when you're talking about a trap, you probably think about animal traps. You trap the animal is dead, done. No. You have no idea what the people did, not only to trap the Americans, but create pain, agony, infections.
I think as much as creating traps that would disable a soldier, it had a psychological effect too. Mm-hmm. And these were like bungee sticks on wheels. They had traps that open and collapse. It would take your whole body down. They had traps with triggers against the wall. It would come and hit you in the chest.
Body.
And the entire body. So again, we had more sophisticated weapons. We had napalm. We had phosphorus. We had, you know, we could outgun them any day of the week. So they used what they had, and it was very effective.
Yeah, I saw that. Those systems were impressive. And this visit to the tunnels, and again, the site is in the middle of a jungle, which is pretty much what you saw everywhere during your service in combat zones. But I thought it was very much the experience that shocked you the most, because you were going to see what you saw back when you were 18 years old in the jungles and encountered. They have dummies, basically, with the same aspect and the same clothing that the Viet Cong and the villagers, the communists, were wearing.
Well, I think this was true throughout Southeast Asia, whether you're in, you know, southern Vietnam or northern Vietnam or Laos, where the Viet Cong were everywhere, and they wore basic black, it looked like pajamas, and the hats that the Asians wear, and sandals, you know, where we wore jungle boots, we had flak jackets or whatever, and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, if you serve there, you remember the tropical jungles of that part of the world where it's just sweat and mosquitoes, but they function very well in that environment. So
yeah, they're familiar with the elements.
Even though we could outgun them, they would hide and attack, and they would live to fight another day. So they could never beat us in a straight up war, but it was kind of, they wore us down over time, especially with the population in this country turning against the war more severely. So, and quite frankly, I'll say this, the war could have probably been over in a month if they'd unleashed the power of the United States military. But, you know, there were other things going on, like the Russians and the Chinese were supplying armaments. And one of the things that my base was responsible for, and it really became a big target because of that, we would drop listening devices over in Laos on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And we had Russian vehicles and Chinese vehicles. So we could tell what the movements, how many vehicles, what the armament was going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And one of our pilots was shot down and captured and was in the POW camp in North Vietnam. And they interrogated him. And they found about our base, and we became more of a target because we were so key in helping identify what was going down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then we launched attacks against the
Chinese and Russians were supporting with armaments to the enemy, to the Viet Cong.
It was a proxy war for the Chinese and the Russians at that time. Like, you know, we have proxy wars going on now in this country. So I think it was some fear that, you know, if we really took out North Vietnam, then that would get the Chinese and the Russians more involved, and it could have expanded. So we went for 10 years, 58,000 guys were killed, hundreds of thousands were wounded. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about whether or not, what the value of that was, and was it worth it?
We'll talk about it, but now let's go back to the tunnels, because part of the visit to the tunnels is having a explanation of what the tunnels were and exactly what the function, what they were doing there. Like, it really, really cleared the picture of what the system of the tunnels were, what was the function of those tunnels. And when we get to that explanation, you have an encounter with the person explaining exactly how those tunnels were built and what was the function. Who that person was, Bruce?
Yeah, we went to the Coochie Tunnels with our guide, and he took us down underground, and it was like the entrance to the tunnels, and it was some seats, and they had a schematic of the tunnels up there, and it was a Viet Cong, former Viet Cong soldier there.
We have pictures here.
And we have pictures. We'll show you all that. And this guy had lost his arm in one of our battles, and he couldn't speak English. So we used our guide, our interpreter, and he told this guy that, you know, I was a U.S. Air Force veteran from that era, and I came back to, you know, see how things work. And, you know, so instantly there was kind of a respect. I mean, the war's over. This is what they were doing. And although we were enemies at one time, there was kind of a bonding and a mutual respect. Anyway, so I joined hands with him, the hand that he had left, along with the son of a North Vietnamese Army regular guy. And we sort of reached hands like this because I could only hold one of his hands. He only had one hand. So that was a very moving moment.
Intense moment. And I have to give a little bit more of the detail here, because I remember that you asked Anne, our guide, you know, this guy, without his arm, he was explaining everything in Vietnamese, and Anne was translated. But after he finished, you ask Anne, say, Anne, I want you to ask him how he feels about me knowing that I was his enemy at that time coming back here. How does he feel about me? And then Anne translated to him, and he answered in Vietnamese, and look at you. And then Anne translated to you, and he said, he feels fine. He said that in Vietnam, they have a say, never look back, only looking forward. He said that he understands that mistakes were made in both sides, and he totally forgive you and forgive himself. And it was the most, I mean, I was there, I couldn't hold my tears. It was unbelievable. And then Anne say, I think we should hold our hands because we all understand that we can reconcile and understand that we have to move forward, that the war is over. So then you guys hold your hands, and I just don't know how I snapped the picture because I was in tears. It was very moving to see how people were considered enemies at one time. After the years, you guys understood the mistakes of a war that it was so unnecessary. So much waste of beautiful human lives. And just releasing that emotion and holding your hands. And the picture says it all. You know, it was smiles and just the release. And the reconciliation was very evident on that moment. I can tell you that.
Well, I don't know if you guys or anybody that's not veterans ever considered Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam is a destination place. And, you know, people seem to want to go to Spain or Portugal or France or whatever. But I can highly recommend, especially if you're a veteran, going back. Because Southeast Asia, in many ways, is the same. In many ways, it's not the same. So I'd highly recommend, if you have the feeling like I did, you want some relief and reconciliation, making that trip is long ways. As you know, you've been over there, you know it's a long ways. And even when you're older, it's even longer. So, but it was worth it. It was well worth it.
So, wow, that was a lot. It was a lot of emotions and part of your healing process. And I say, good, we're good for the day. This has been a lot. And then Anne say, no, we have another stop to make. Okay, that was at the end of the day. We're going to the War Remnants Museum, which is a vivid perspective of the American War. That's how the Vietnamese called the war, the American War, through the eyes of the Vietnamese. And that probably was the most emotionally intense experience of the entire trip.
Yes, this is a three-story, call it a museum, in pictorial and artifacts of, and big pictures of what went on, everything. I mean, extremely graphic. I have to tell you, it's extremely graphic. We took some pictures, but some were too graphic, in my opinion, to show on this podcast. But, you know, everything from the My Lai massacre to our troops in foxholes with bandages around their eyes to, you know, just... And I guess this was one of the things that was most devastating was the spraying of the Agent Orange to defoliate the jungle so we could have more line of sight to the enemy, do better bombing of the enemy. The Agent Orange is extremely caustic, and a lot of veterans like myself and like you guys, have been affected. Some have died due to Agent Orange exposure, but the people that lived there were drenched in this stuff. They had pictures of malformed births, conjoined twins, eyeballs out here on both sides of the head.
All
it was just amazing. And it took, I think, something like, what was it, Claudia, 25 years for the land
recover. What they told us was that, and you will see that on the pictures, the devastation by the chemical exposure. This chemical, the Agent Orange, is so toxic that it's a defoliant, but it will kill any living thing around. And then kill the dirt, poison the dirt. So the people not only suffer for the toxicity for years, they couldn't grow food. I mean, the famine. Imagine the dirt was totally polluted and poisoned. It took time to help regenerate the dirt. And now they start growing their food again about 20 years ago. It's just amazing what is happening in the last 20 years. And we can go in depth on this, but to see the devastation. And again, those pictures on that museum are so shocking to see how we humans, have this tremendous potential to destroy ourselves, is create so much harm. It was very, very, very disturbing.
In many ways, it seems such a waste of blood and treasure that we had. I mean, to move, the number of troops that cycled through that area of the world cost gazillions of dollars. And then what was the result? I mean, we lost 58,000 wonderful people. I've worked for the best corporations in the world. General Electric, IBM, McKesson Corporation. But the best people that I've ever known were the people that I served with in the military services. The best people I've ever known. So going back to the Coochie Tunnels, I just remembered that the guide told me that only 15% of the armament that we dropped in that area has ever been recovered. There's still situations where somebody's in a field and something blows up. So, I mean, the remnants go on 50 some years later. There is not animosity, with the people. You know, we lost 58,000. They lost 3 million.
3 million.
3 million, and with about 2 million injured. So it was tragic on both sides. And, I won't debate whether it was right or wrong, but the net of it, when you see it, it's like, what a waste. What a waste. And I think we should be more diligent and more mindful before we commit our troops, our well-trained, good people to a war, unless it's a purpose that's clear. To me, it's too important. People's lives are too important.
And to see these people today and through the journey, through the trip, over and over, we're seeing different examples of the beauty, the love, and the humbleness of the people. It's very refreshing and it's extremely uplifting. And I just think that when we went to the Delta River, the Mekong Delta, I wanted to see the countryside, and you wanted to show me that because, again, that was part of the, like, you wanted to see how they recover after the devastation, after the Agent Orange. And not only that, we don't even mention the napalm. That is that chemical jelly thing that it was dropped to burn people.
I mean, we had napalm at our base that, we flew missions with A1E Sandys over in the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So we dropped just hundreds of millions of tons of napalm, and also phosphorus. So there were pictures of people just burned severely through phosphorus and napalm. So it was horrible. It was horrible. You know, we were there in the midst of war, and it's crazy. But reflecting back on it, it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. But anyway, we went from there to where?
Claudia, the next, one thing I have to say is that day was so intense and emotionally charged and traumatic for you to see that again, that you got so sick, you get fever, you were sweating. I have to go to get medicine for you. And I knew it was nothing that you ate, no, that you're getting flu. No, I knew it was 100% emotional. I mean, next day you were feeling fine, but it was just the release of that emotional, heaviness, and seeing that again that caused that reaction on your body. But the next day we went to the Mekong Delta River, as you want to show me and see with your own eyes, what happened after, you know, the war, how they recovered the land, and it was very beautiful. I will say it was a joy to see the people, especially, and I think you probably agree with me.
Yeah, we have some pictures of Saigon, a very, very, very busy city now, 14 million people, 8 million, I won't say motorcycles, they're motorbikes, and you pull up to a traffic light and a queue of about 100 motorcycles are there, and your driver wants to turn right through them. There's no traffic control. It seems like they all know
I
what
didn't
to
see
do.
Police.
It seems like controlled chaos to me, but there's
it's
no police.
Agreement. They are in agreement on what to do.
But anyway, Saigon.
But then we went to the Delta River. I want to go to the people, because that was very beautiful to see the countryside. And again, these people on that part of the country were the ones directly affected by the war.
Yeah, but that's all healed now. And
it is beautiful.
People are doing fine. It's beautiful.
So from that part of the trip, you say that you wanted to go to Da Nang.
Yeah,
Da Nang is a city on the coast. And why you want to go there?
Well, I'd never been there, you know, and a lot, you know, I spent most of my time in Thailand and Laos and some in North Vietnam and some places I don't even know where I was. But I had never been to Da Nang. And I wanted to go there because I'd always heard about the, what went on over there in terms of, I think it was the 3rd Marine Division over there and the battles at Hamburger Hill is only like 3 hours away from there. My Lai is like 2 hours away from there. And so that was a kind of a hotbed of action. And I wanted to see that. Plus, it's on the South China Sea, which I wanted to kind of take a look at that because now the Chinese say they own the South China Sea. So I wanted to see what Da Nang was like. So we went there, and our first stop was a place called Marble Mountain, and some of you folks may remember that. It was also used as a refuge for the Viet Cong because there's tunnels all through this mountain. This made out of solid marble. It's absolutely gorgeous.
That place was also used for the Viet Cong to hide,
I mean, it's a tourist attraction today, and they've carved a lot of beautiful carvings out of the marble, and they sell a lot of the marble all over the world. But it was a refuge for the Viet Cong at that particular point in time. But then we went to other areas of Da Nang. You might want to talk about Hoi An. Claudia.
Yes, I mean, Hoi An was probably the most beautiful town that I ever seen in my life. Was beautiful, considered to be a very prosperous port, and now is actually it is considered a World Heritage ancient town because of his well-preserved architecture, which reflects the influence from the Chinese and the Japanese and the Vietnamese culture over the thousands of years. So it was unbelievable place. And the people, I'm going back to the people, they have a very, I would say, a very, you know, market full of people and spices and food. Something that I like to mention very much here is that they are growing, they grow their own food in Vietnam, mostly organically, and they sell it on the markets, and it's a joy to see it now. So the Hoi An was absolutely beautiful, but also in Hoi An, we went to this place. It's a museum of a French photographer. It's called Ri Han. And I want to mention it that because I want the listeners that are considering visiting, don't miss going to Hoi An and visiting this museum. Again, the French photographer name is Ri Han. I'm leaving and all of this in description box here, his website, and, you know, mentioning of his beautiful photographies. He dedicated over 10 years to investigating the ancient tribes in Vietnam, capturing on his camera the most amazing images of the beautiful people of the villages. And the ancient traditions and their customs, which they use hand-woven hemp, stitching, dyeing, and embroidery of the clothing. And as you know, manufacturing of clothing is something very deep into the Vietnamese culture. And we went there and we saw the pictures that Ri Han took of all of these old people, the elderly, the young, in those villages. And there's a reason why he's called the photographer who captures the souls. It's a reason for that, because when you see those pictures, you see the beauty and the honesty and the authenticity of the people. Same people that were suffering from the horrors of the war, see them today, happy, thriving, smiling, positive, healthy. It was very nice to see that.
So to kind of recap, Claudia's podcast is all about health and wellness, ways that we can physically and mentally, she says it's meant for the body, mind, and soul, and helping us stay healthy, mentally healthy, and physically healthy. So this podcast today is a tribute to those who served in Southeast Asia and all of the countries. I think it was about 8.75 million vets during the Vietnam War served, and 40% of those served in Vietnam and the surrounding countries, including Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. And today, 6.3 million Vietnam veterans are still alive. So we have a good population out there. And me reminiscing about my military history and going back to that part of the world, I wanted to share that with you. Pictures, videos, our accounts. Again, I was going to go back by myself and just kind of see things. Claudia's working, I'm retired, but she insisted that she went with me. And I think it totally impacted her almost as much as it did me. So it was a wonderful experience. And I guess, Claudia,
I have a last question for you before you close remarks here, Bruce. Talking about PTSD traumas, memories of war, silent wars. A lot of our veterans keep those memories and that battle inside, and they're not talking about it. But you're suffering PTSD. You're reaching out for help to the Veteran Administration, join the PTSD groups, and talking, and going through this journey on this trip for healing. My question to you is: do you think that after seeing the people, looking at their eyes and seeing the places today that you were there 57 years ago, you feel more peace. You feel that healing that you were looking for.
Absolutely. You know, when I look at the people and I see them happy going about their everyday activities, simple as they are, it just comes to my mind that they're okay. They're fine. And I'm fine, and we're both fine. So, and again, their attitude is not to look back, but to look forward. So they were very inviting. And our guide in Da Nang said, "Hey, I loved having you here. Please go back and tell your veteran friends to come to Vietnam." So that's kind of the sentiment that I felt. I didn't want to leave you with this thought. I joined the American Legion, you know, after I got in the military. I went about building my career, and I really didn't have time for that, or didn't know about it. I knew it existed. My father was a member of the American Legion, so I joined. So I go into the post and kind of belly up to the bar with the other vets there with their hats on, and see, they were either in Korea, Vietnam, or wherever. But it's been kind of very satisfying to me, and Claudia and I working with the American Legion Corporate on the Be the One program. And I just kind of wanted to lead with a comment in the American Legion magazine that I get every month. This part was about the mission fulfilled. Vietnam Women's Memorial continues to inspire after 30 years. But it was the excerpt from the commander of the American Legion, Daniel Seehofer. I just wanted to read that. On March 29th, American Legion posts across the nation will again lead their communities in observing National Vietnam War Veterans Day. On this day, we honor more than 3 million Americans who served in and around a country in Southeast Asia that most had never heard of until they were asked to risk their lives for it. On this day, we remember 58,318 dead whose names are engraved in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., a list that does not include thousands of subsequent deaths due to Agent Orange-related illnesses, suicide, and other conditions related to their time in service. On this day, we say, welcome home to the men and women who were at times jeered and disrespected because they answered their nation's call. So I want to say thank you to my brothers and sisters, and welcome home.
Thank you, Bruce, for your words. And again, this beautiful reflection on the service and how we can be part of the solution and support of the veterans battling with PTSD and mental illnesses. I just want to tell my audience here, if you don't know how to be part of the solution, something you can do is participate of the Be the One program. Be the One is the initiative by the American Legion to help end veteran suicide. And something very simple that you can do, because most of you guys drink coffee. You love your coffee in the morning. Well, get our Be the One coffee in our Expressol Coffee website, www.expressolcoffee.com, because a portion of each sale goes to the American Legion, Be the One, to help end veteran suicide. Purchase this coffee and help the veterans in need.
Let me bring I think that was all I was going to say, but I do want to bring one statistic to mind.
Go ahead.
58,000 died in Vietnam, 30-some thousand in Korea, and like 8,000 in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's around 101,000 deaths in the last three wars going back 60 years. Since 2001, 125,000 veterans have committed suicide. More deaths due to suicide PTSD related, Agent Orange related, burn pit related, than the last three wars we were involved in. That is horrible. That this is something that we can do something about. This is fixable. 23 of us, 23 veterans, whether it pick your war, but they're committing suicide every day. And they have a story. Listen to their story. They want to be relevant. And I tell you, veterans who are suffering that quiet war, your mission is not over yet. So reach out. Talk to somebody from the American Legion. Be the one to help somebody suffering. Be the one. So
be the one.
All I have to say.
Thank you very much. And thank you, our listeners. Again, follow us in all our social media outlets and leave us your comments below. We love to hear from you. Did you like this episode? Did you learn something from the perspective of war, from PTSD? Do you know someone that may need help? Are you one of those veterans suffering this silent war inside of you? Do you? I'm telling you, we care about you. We are here to help. And thank you for being with us. Until next time, remember, health is wealth for the body, mind, and soul. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. And if you like the information that we shared with you today, please subscribe to the Express Soul Health and Wellness podcast and follow us in the social media outlets of your choice. Until next time, please remember, health is wealth for the body, mind, and soul.